the OTB Podcast Network.
The Ligue 1 title race is something that usually gets spoken about in pretty patronising terms. It's Paris Saint-Germain's league and everybody else is just living in it. Not so this year, and on Sunday we had a pretty big game in the title race in Ligue 1. We had Lyon against Lille. Lille on top of the table, but they were 2 goals down against Lyon, brought it back from 2 goals down to go to 2-2, and then in the 85th minute this happened. And this is all in French, but I think it's pretty clear what's going on.
On est dans le camp lillois, on est très loin derrière là, on se met un peu en difficulté, la Botman va faire sortir ce ballon. Sven Botman, voilà, le long ballon de Sven Botman, Youssouf Yazici de la tête, qui peut détourner pour Bourak Yılmaz qui emmène un peu loin son ballon, Bourak Yılmaz, et le but, Bourak Yılmaz, yeah!
Bourak Yılmaz, he is the man of the hour, Philippe Auclair.
Yes, he said he's the man of the season. He's the man of the weekend. He's the man of the match. He's extraordinary, isn't he? 35 years of age. You thought that's it. His career, I wouldn't say it was over, but he was really entering the, very last few furlongs of the straight, of the final straight. And here he is scoring this incredible goal at the weekend. I would imagine that's the winning goal against Lyon that you just played right now, which suddenly made Lille come back from 2-0 down, win 3-2 at the end of the game. And what a story, what a player, and what a story.
So we're all hopping on the Ligue 1 bandwagon at this point, because we're like, oh look, Paris Saint-Germain aren't going to run away with this thing. How good a season has this been overall?
It's been terrific. And you know, before talking to you, I was reflecting on it. Why hasn't it been so terrific? And I think the answer to that is that we should think of a new system for the French League to start PSG with a handicap, basically, you know, like in a horse race. What happened is that, you remember they played, of course, the final of the Champions League and last season, which means that they had barely any time to get ready for the start of the new one. I mean, they were not ready. And so they lost their first 2 games. So -6. And if you've got PSG -6, you have a great season, because right now we have Lille ahead, PSG 1 point behind, and the rather wonderful AS Monaco as well, 1 point behind PSG. So this promises to be an absolutely fantastic end to the season. Only 4 games to go. And there've been some great performances along the way. And I have to say, Lille makes a wonderful leader, would make a great champion. PSG haven't been rubbish since Pochettino has arrived, but they've got against them this time a super Lille. And I insist on that, a super Monaco, a team that really, really impresses me and has been in the background for a while, but is finishing, at a rate of knots. I think it's 5 wins on the trot now, 15 goals scored, 0 conceded, an absolutely super team. I mean, a super squad, with a very fine manager. Niko Kovac was proving he's a very fine manager, and has made them one of the most pleasing teams in Europe on the eye. So it's been that good, yes.
Is it the managerial genius? Is it a strange coalition of certain players coming into good form? I mean, I haven't paid enough attention to Ligue 1 in recent seasons to know if this has come from nowhere, but certainly at this level where they're going toe-to-toe with Paris Saint-Germain, it feels a little bit like it's almost out of nowhere.
Yes, well, I would say that Christophe Galtier is probably, with the exception of Mauricio Pochettino, the best manager in Ligue 1. And I think most people would agree with me on this. He did a superb job at Saint-Etienne, which was a very difficult job to do, and perhaps was not given the credit that he deserved because of the kind of football that his team played. But he made do with what he had at his disposal, which, believe me, wasn't that much. And got some great results, took them into Europe. And then at Lille, well, we know what he's been doing. But at Lille, he's basically had to rebuild his team every single year, because it's a club that has been built. First of all, it's a club which has had some very, very serious financial problems. And it's a club which has built its modus operandi on the purchase and sale of players. And therefore, he's had to rebuild every year, losing his best players every year. You know, and he's managed to do that with the help of a very talented sports director, who is the other hero, I think, of the story. Certainly not the former owner, João Lopes, but it's quite something what Christophe Galtier has achieved there.
Is that the type of level of achievement that ends up being poached by another club, or is he a lifer, do you think, here at Lille now that the situation suits him?
No, he's. I'm pretty sure that Christophe Galtier will be in Lyon next year. And I'm actually surprised that other clubs haven't thought of him. I'm thinking in the Premier League, for example. He's really one of the. He's one of the best, probably the best French manager actually of his generation. Which is, I've just said that, but he's not. He's about Zidane's generation, so maybe I exaggerate a little bit. But he's he's certainly a very, very fine coach. He hasn't been with very glamorous teams. But one thing I would say for him is that, having talked to a few of his players in the clubs that he's managed, they all talk about it's a play on words in French. They say entraîneur in French. Entraîner is not just to coach, is to take somebody along. And he has a way to make his players believe in what he does and take them along and achieving great things with them because they believe in him. He's got that. It's a very rare talent. It's perhaps the most important talent of them all when you're a manager, and he has it. And so there you go. Lille is now a favorite for the title because PSG have got a tricky schedule, which is much trickier because of what they've got to do at the same time, which is not just the French Cup, of which they play the semi-final against Montpellier, but obviously the Champions League doubleheader against Manchester City, which obviously is going to define their season. So Lille doesn't have this to worry about, and neither has Monaco, by the way.
Not only will it define their season, Philippe, I think it's something that everybody around the world who loves football is really looking forward to, Pep versus Pochettino. Just the sort of explosion of excitement we've got when these two have met in the past, especially on European nights, has been amazing. Do you expect it to live up to the hype first off this tie?
I, strangely enough, I'm expecting perhaps a cagier occasion. To be honest, I'm not absolutely sure of what I expect for this because there's still one question to be answered, which is whether Kylian Mbappe is going to be fit or not. And I think that will, very much decide how the games will look, because PSG without Mbappe is not the same PSG at all. And we thought he would be ready, but the last I've heard, he had to go off the pitch last weekend in the 3-1 victory against Metz, against whom he again scored a double, which I think takes him to something like 37 goals for the season, which is just ridiculous. But he had to be taken off the pitch with a knock. And at the beginning, we thought it was not serious, but apparently yesterday he only trained very, very lightly. And it's not 100% sure he's going to be part of it, which would be an absolute shame, because that's, that's what we all want to see. The Mbappé we've seen of late has been simply transcendent. And we want to see him against Manchester City. But again, not absolutely sure. And I don't exactly know what to expect. And I think perhaps a cagier game. I mean, so much is at stake for these two. We're really talking about, I know this is a cliche, the Holy Grail, but for both clubs, which would completely change the perspective we have. In the case of PSG, it would completely change, I think, the perspective people have on them. They would have arrived at the finally. And up to also when it comes to Manchester City, it would also change the perception we have of them as a team, not as a club. Because there's, of course, the other element of this, which is the Qatar, United Arab Emirates confrontation, which is fascinating. I could think of many other adjectives, but it is certainly fascinating in its own right.
Well, I mean, Philippe, they stood up for the small man in football last week by not joining the European Super League. So everybody's on board the Qatar train right now, I'm sure, in France.
Yes, it's been rather interesting to see because I didn't think I would see the day when Nasser Al-Khelaifi would be seen as a kind of saviour of football. It's a bit strange. But I think there has been this, first of all, the relief has been such. And there's a little bit of schadenfreude. And there's also a bit that they were not stupid enough to get, to embark themselves on that boat that was leaking water even before it had been put out to sea. And of course, he's a very powerful man. He's perhaps the most powerful man in world football at the moment, bar Gianni Infantino. When you think of everything that he is, you know, he's now chairman of the ECA, he's the chairman of beIN Sports, he sits on the executive committee, he sits on the UEFA executive committee, he's the chairman of PSG, and on and on and on. So he has, I mean, so many caps, it's just extraordinary. But in France, this is what it is. PSG is not the target of as much rancor as you would imagine, or rather, this rancor is never made public. Not everybody loves PSG in France, far from it, starting with the OM, with the Marseille supporters. And there are some people, like me, who also have been asking questions of the way the club is run and where the money comes from and what it stands for and all the sports washing aspect of PSG. But at the moment, they're walking on water. Nasser Al-Khelaifi is walking on water. And I mean, we shouldn't forget this is a man who was in a Swiss court accused of bribes not that long ago. And actually, the case is not completely closed. But that doesn't prevent people from seeing a kind of hero in him, which is, again, extraordinary because I don't think it's a secret that the only reason PSG was not going to go into that was because of the backers of this particular Super League project, and also the fact that it probably would have spelled the end for the broadcasting contracts which beIN Sport, of which Nasser Al-Khelaifi is a chairman, has with UEFA and various leagues which are totally against the Super League. So I think this has been conveniently forgotten, I think, when debated in France.
I think the other thing is that if you buy a European club to try and win the European Cup, you have to win the European Cup before you can move on to the next thing and say, oh yeah, that's fine. But the whole point was that you're trying to buy the history of the Bayern Munich team in the 70s, the Ajax team in the 70s, Arrigo Sacchi's Milan. If that competition suddenly disappears, what's the point in trying to? You've built something to win this other thing, which is new. Like the point of the sports washing and leaning into that is that it's a long continuum back through the history of football.
Yes, but and of course the other thing is that among the clubs. Which approached to be part of the Super League. We shouldn't forget that PSG were approached, by the way. They were supposed to be one of the 15. I think only two, perhaps three, are in a position where they could simply forget about the financial situation. And one of them being perhaps Chelsea, and I'm not even sure when I say that, I actually have doubts about it myself. And the two being Manchester City and PSG, who basically don't have to worry about financial fair play anymore, and have got limitless means at their disposal, and were not at all in the same financial situation as, for example, a Real Madrid or a Barcelona, which has now accrued 1 billion in debts and also is losing hemorrhaging money, or even worse, the Italian clubs. So those were completely desperate and are still completely desperate, and it's one of the reasons why they behaved the way they did and why they perhaps sped up the process, because they know that they could be doomed, financially speaking, completely lose it. And this is actually true also of Arsenal up to a point, but not of PSG and Manchester City. So, which perhaps explains perhaps as well how lukewarm their support was in the case of Manchester City, even though they were involved, I mean, for quite a while. And they signed the document, and of PSG, who basically could just ignore the whole thing and carry on their merry way.
Philip, you've obviously been covering the politics of football as well as the actual game itself for a long period of time, and I'm interested in where you think this goes next, particularly in the context of Arsenal, now that you've just mentioned it there. The fact that three legendary players are coming out to support the potential takeover by the creator of Spotify from the Cronkies suggests that football has not learned any lessons. Like, what the Arsenal fans and the Arsenal legends want is just a slightly better class of billionaire, a more acceptable billionaire.
Well, you say that. I don't think that Mr. Eck is more acceptable than Kroenke at all. Well, I don't think so. I think he's an even worse example of late-stage capitalism than Kroenke. Kroenke is almost an old-style capitalist. We know exactly what we get with Kroenke. With Eck, we get as well the complete puff, a cool brand, but which is even more exploitative than Kroenke's operations. So I speak here as a journalist, as an Arsenal fan, and as a musician. So so I think, yes, we've reached quite a point in the development of football, if people could see that. But to be honest, many people I've spoken to within, you know, the Arsenal microcosm or macrocosm are extremely, they're happy about the involvement of former legends. And don't forget Mathieu Flamini as well would be involved, who is actually the businessman among the older players, the ex-players. But nobody's too thrilled about Spotify, be it on a personal basis by Mr. Eck or as a brand thing, which actually probably Mr. Eck himself, billionaire. And also, and by the way, the money would probably not be his, but he would raise the money through some kind of investment
fund. The same way the Glazers did.
Yeah,
exactly.
To be honest, that's exactly what I think, and which is one of the. To be honest, I genuinely don't think it's going to happen. I genuinely don't think it's going to happen. The club is valued. His club is valued at something like $2 billion at the moment, which in the current circumstances, to be honest, you would have to be completely utterly mad to invest in a football club that has, in terms of sporting terms, has gone down ever since Wenger. Well, I would say since the second decade of Arsene Wenger's reign, but which is now a mid-table club, which financially is going absolutely nowhere, which relies on gate receipts more than any other club in England. Not exactly one of the best characteristics at the moment, and we don't know what's around the corner either. Or rather, we have an idea that it might not come back to normal that quickly. That has fallen down the rich list of Deloitte's season after season and is now has now left the top 10. And you can carry on like that. I mean, to invest $2 million in that. Well, if it's not your own money, if you and I could buy Arsenal without having to spend a penny, we probably would do it, wouldn't we?
Well, I mean, if I was bored in my day job and had loads of time on my hands, and you know, yeah,
let's buy Arsenal.
I think you're dead right, though. I think it's really interesting to me that this mad outcry about the Super League happens, but actually, the thing that allowed it to happen, I see many Arsenal fans happy about this. This is like, this is great. We're getting rid of the Kroenkes. We're moving on to something new. It's like you're literally just replacing the problem with the same problem. And
I think that in the mind of some supporters, it's the fact that they feel that the Kroenkes have been so reluctant to invest money in the club, and investing money in the club means buying players, that they think that Eck, who is apparently an Arsenal supporter, but also apparently has looked at other clubs before looking at Arsenal, which is a bit of a contradiction in terms, isn't it? They think that, you know, Arsenal would have an owner who this time would be able to bankroll the club and to invest money, and that would change and therefore would improve the results. And then, of course, if you have people like Bergkamp and Vieira and Henry, three of the greatest players, not just of Arsenal, but in the history of Premier League and of English football, with you, obviously you look at it in a completely different way from Le Kroenke. The Kroenke is Stan in Colorado, and Josh, whom everybody seems to detest. So it's a difference, but it's not a difference. It's exactly, it's part of the same problem, and not necessarily part of the same of a solution.
If you're saying that you would be mad to buy Arsenal Football Club for £2 billion at this moment, does that not suggest that the Kroenkes are quite likely to sell if that price is met?
well said, touche. If that price is met, if they're there for the long run, and this is what appears to be the case, if they're there for a longer run, I mean, the place of Arsenal in their portfolio, we shouldn't forget Arsenal is really like a, what would you call that, a blue ribbon brand to have. Sorry to use, but it's a brand as well. In their portfolio, and in a way is almost like a kind of security for the other operations that they have in their sports empire. And if you look at it in the longer term, I'm sure if a club, you know, Arsenal is not going to go bust tomorrow. That's not what I'm intending to say. And in the longer term, you've got a fantastic fan base. You've still got quite a good stadium, a big one. you're part of a league that is very successful. So if you long beyond, if you look beyond the 2-3 years that we're going to have to deal with, and you think, well, it's a commercial proposal of great interest, so it is worth a lot of money. So there's no reason why you're going to, they're never going to sell it for less than it's worth. What I'm saying is that at the moment, as an investment, I would like to see the justification of that. It seems to me a peculiar, it probably is a good moment to hold on to your assets or actually to sell them at a very good price if you can, but it's not necessarily the best of moments to acquire new assets.
Yeah, or maybe to realise that value as well. Philippe, there's a lot of love coming in for you in our comments. The sage of European football, says Sarragan McKenney. And Mangesh says, always love listening to Philippe, always insightful, calm and composed, one of the best pundits around. So, you know, we need to share more love. That's what we need to do in the world, to share more love. Particularly.
Absolutely, more love. We want more love.
Exactly. One last thing, speaking of this, Eric Cantona is out at the moment with, he's voiced and helped produce a new documentary about the United Way. And you've got particular insight to Cantona. I'm always fascinated by what's Cantona's relationship like with France and the French?
Conflictual, ambiguous, uneasy. I think those three terms probably describe it better than anything else. I mean, the last time I knew, actually, he used to live in kind of posh suburb of Paris, and he moved to Lisbon. And he's always, I'm not aware that he's come back to France. I think he still stays in Portugal. Might be wrong. Apologies if I am. And he's always considered himself to be an English footballer. I mean, there's a lot of posturing when it comes with Eric. And so he says that to annoy people a little bit. On the other hand, he's as French can be. He's as Marseillais can be. But he has a very conflictual and strange relationship with France, and which has to do with the strange relationship he had with the French national team. And we shouldn't forget I've always maintained that he was a superb servant of the French national team up until a moment when things really went wrong and, you know, the problem started with the hierarchy. But when he was called on, he always responded present. He had a fantastic goal scoring record, which people have forgotten about completely. And his lack of luck was that he was part of a generation that didn't achieve what the previous generation had with Platini and the others, and what the following generation achieved with Zizou and company, which he could have been a part of, but he was just on the cusp and then famously refused to be part of the Euro 96 squad. And this completely taints his relationship with the country, because Eric Cantona sees the world as very much Eric Cantona's world. So everything is judged in relationship to what happened to him. And if he thinks he was in a way mistreated or that his country betrayed him up to a point, then obviously you're going to have a very strange relationship with that. And he exasperates as many people as he enthralls them in France. People ask very often in France to see how seriously he's taken abroad, particularly in England. I would say that's the one thing that people say. They can't believe quite that he's taken as seriously as he is in England. And you know, in that he's given things like he wrote this new documentary. Well, in France it wouldn't happen, would it?
It's really interesting. It's fascinating how he made another life for himself that's completely separate and different, and the perception is so different. And it speaks to the human capability for redefining ourselves and rebirth and all that kind of stuff, and also for bearing grudges, because I feel like the grudge that he bears fed the fuel and the fire that he had at Manchester United.
I think it's one of these people who needs to be angry to succeed as a footballer and probably perhaps as a man. It's actually a quality that is present in many top footballers. I remember talking to Thierry Henry about it, and he said that one of his defining qualities, he thought, was his anger, that he was never satisfied with anything. And Cantona needs to have, you know, a peaceful Cantona is of no use to anyone. When he had his greatest season, which probably was 95-96, I would say, would you agree with me, when he came back from suspension?
Yeah.
And he seemed to be a different character, and he seems to be to have calmed down when you did all this community service and so forth. And every time Manchester United scored, won 1-0, you could bet that the goal had been scored by Eric Cantona, and he seemed more at peace with himself. But in fact, I think it was just a pent-up anger, which was just like, it was on slow release, like a tire, you know, just letting a little bit of air rather than exploding. And in the end, and yet the Chile ended with a, you know, in the end with in 96, 97, but he had this thing in him, he had to prove people wrong. I'm going to prove you. You thought I was wrong jumping in the crowd. You thought I was the wrong kind that you could cuss me out of football. I'm going to show you. I'm angry with you. I hate you. And this is what produced the best football of his life.
Yeah, fascinating stuff, Philippe. Great to have you with us this morning. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Enjoy these games this week as well. That's Philippe Auclair, and as I said, a lot of love coming in for him on the text machine, 087 9 180 180, if you want to get in touch. I'd watch the hell out of a six-part, 2 hours per episode, Eric Cantona documentary on.
Yeah, that's the character they need to do it on. So the newest one is The United Way. I think it's coming out soon. And obviously they got the best man for the gig to narrate it and to be the voice of the whole thing.
What a changing room that would have been with like the young brooding Keane and the old brooding Cantona. Can you just imagine? Like, and them all on the absolute piss all the time. I wonder, was Cantona, did he like his nights out? Did he go out and have a few drinks with the lads?
I'd say in a very different way to how the British and Irish lads would have enjoyed their night out. Like, was Cantona a member of the Monday Club, the Tuesday Club, for example?
I don't think so.
I don't suspect he was.
I'd say that, you know, he might have been sitting there having an ale cocktail, maybe?
I'd say an espresso.
A cigarette,
definitely.
OTBAM is live in association with Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette, giving you the confidence to tackle the day ahead.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.